Hello, boys and girls. Welcome in to the Boys and Girl Podcast with Cowboys NFL Network reporter Jane Slater and NFL Network producer Bobby Belt. A Cowboys community with the inside scoop on the Dallas Cowboys. Now, coming straight to you from the Lone Star State, here's Jane and Bobby.
All right. Well, just when we thought that the offseason of this pandemic was going to slow down Cowboys news or everything that we could talk to the fans about, I feel like we need to do a podcast more than once a week, Bobby, because the Cowboys have remained active. You know, as we've talked about, the Cowboys told us, one of my sources had said that in the draft, they had addressed a lot of areas, so they weren't going to be in this rush to sign anybody. In other words, they don't have this glaring need right now. They also told me that scouting is a 24/7, 365 job. And they went out and they scouted themselves a starting quarterback that's going to play backup here in Dallas. And I'm talking about Andy Dalton. Your initial thoughts, Bobby?
I like it. I think it's always good to have, you know, a strong backup. I remember I was talking to James Washington, the old Cowboys safety, years ago, and he was on the early 90s teams, and he talked about that at the end of 1990 when Troy Aikman got hurt, that the Cowboys had decided internally that they were never going to let that happen again, that they were never going to be caught with a poor backup behind them. And so through that, they had Steve Berline, and that was crucial for them in 1991 when he won a playoff game for them as the backup. And then, you know, Bernie Kosar and Rodney Peete and Wade Wilson, they always were stacking up good veteran backup quarterbacks. And so it was something they did for a long time, and then they kind of moved away from it. I think they've become a little comfortable with Dak Prescott's durability, and they were seeing some of the ridiculous figures that go out there for backup quarterbacks. But in the end, it makes too much sense. We don't know the exact escalation of the deal yet, but it can be up to $7 million is what's being reported. It's $3 million guaranteed. More than they've spent on a backup quarterback in recent history, but a guy who I think is definitely worth it, and a guy who is going to be a good partner for Dak Prescott and a good study partner and somebody behind him that can do good work during the week, I think, and somebody, by all accounts, that is a great locker room guy. And so it should be, I think it's a positive signing. It's a good one. I don't know that we should buy into the conspiracy theories that this is a attempt to move Dak Prescott in a certain direction, but maybe that's a small part of it. Maybe it gives them an ability to say, hey, look, you know, yeah, we still want to work out a deal, but if you're holding out, you know, if you're still not happy by summer, we just got to have a contingency in place. And so maybe there's a little bit of an added benefit to doing that. But overall, I think a good signing, just a little bit of a surprising one, given that's not the direction they've gone in recent years, is paying a good backup.
All signs continue to point to Mike McCarthy. I just think of how active they've been in free agency and the quality of the free agents that they've gone out and acquired. Coy signing, Dontari Poe, Alden, if and when he gets reinstated. And then, of course, a guy like Andy Dalton. I'm with you. This feels very much like what the Saints did with Teddy Bridgewater. A lot of people were shocked that the Saints went out there and paid him that type of money. I'd reported at the time that the Miami Dolphins wanted him to be a potential starter for them, even after they picked up, well, what's his face from the Cardinals?
Josh Rosen, yeah.
Josh Rosen. He wasn't going to be the guy that wanted to go and take that. He wanted to flourish and sort of learn from the Saints, because that was a locker room that he was familiar with. And in this case, you know, I've talked to his old coach at TCU, Gary Patterson. Gary Patterson said it is just that. At a house here, he still lives in the Dallas area in the off season, and with this pandemic and not really knowing what that's going to look like, I think there's a level of comfort that comes with being able to stick around the Dallas area to play, and then kind of do what Teddy Bridgewater did, which was go and get yourself a starting job with, in his case, the Panthers. And so, and again, this also feels like the Alfred Morris signing when they were going through the Ezekiel Elliott deal. We all knew that it wasn't a guy that was going to replace Zeke. It was just an added insurance policy. And to me, he feels like a more accomplished Mark Sanchez for Dak Prescott in that room. I think we saw Dak Prescott really flourish in his rookie season, having a guy like that in there, a guy that was able to read defenses a certain way. He'd had some experience. And now you've got a guy like that in Andy Dalton in Dallas that can really, you know, push Dak. And then we were so impressed with Ben DiNucci, a guy they picked up in the seventh round, as another guy that gives them insurance. And, of course, the Cowboys announcing on Monday that they let Cooper Rush go. I liked Cooper, but you and I saw it at training camp the last 2 years. This was not a guy that you wanted to step in the event you have a situation like, again, the Saints had Drew Brees going out and needing somebody that's going to step in and help sustain them until your starter comes back and then help you make a playoff push.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, the Cowboys have been trying to replace Cooper Rush for a little bit. You know, they drafted Mike White and that didn't work out. They wanted him to be the guy behind Dak and the developmental guy. That just didn't, you know, work out the way they wanted it to. So they've been working, I think, trying to push him and find a better person for that spot. But yeah, I mean, the Cowboys, they clearly do. They have a type, you know, everybody's got their type, like, you know, that they're, you know, I like a blonde girl, you know, with a pretty smile or whatever else. You know, the Cowboys like their redheaded backup quarterbacks, Cooper Rush, Brandon Whedon, Jason Garrett, Andy Dalton. They are, they certainly have a type and they go for it.
That's really funny, actually, the way that you put that. That was, I didn't know where you're going with that. And I enjoyed that analogy there.
It's got to be Jerry, because those are all Jerry era backups that are the redheads.
Let's also talk about Jerry Jones and what he told us on draft night. They went and picked up CeeDee Lamb, mm-hmm. a decadent pick that you and I discussed at 17. A guy that hadn't even probably thought about what jersey number he was going to wear. And the owner of the Dallas Cowboys says that his old college teammate mm-hmm. had passed away and his number was 88. And he wanted CeeDee Lamb to wear 88. And we talk about there's a Romo beehive. Well, there's also a Bryant beehive. And it just set the world on fire. And while I thought he was being a little tongue-in-cheek, I don't think that I expected that he would necessarily go through with it, in the sense that CeeDee Lamb picked 88. So now he joins the 88 club, and we're going to have Drew Pearson on here in a little bit just to talk about what that 88 club means and his thoughts on CeeDee Lamb now acquiring that jersey. I will say this about Dez, of course, tweeting out his support of CeeDee Lamb. And a lot of people have asked me, so what does this mean for Dez? My honest answer is I don't know. Here's what I do know. Dez has been reaching out to teams himself. He already admitted that when he reached out to Stephen Jones last year. He reached out to Sean Payton. Of course, he's still with Roc Nation and he has an agent, but Dez is working for himself right now. And I know there's at least one other team in the league. He was very intrigued by it. And when things can open up again, they want to bring Dez in for a live workout. So there is a good chance that Dez might end up on a roster come training camp. Whether he'll be on the roster when the season starts, still unclear. And whether he'll be with the Cowboys still unclear as well. I mean, when you consider that they've got Amari Cooper, CeeDee Lamb, Michael Gallup, it does feel like this would be a tough place for Dez, even though Dez says he doesn't want to be like Jason Witten and come back. In other words, never not be on the football field. I think Dez is such a competitor. And while, you know, I think the Sean Payton plan when he went to the Saints was a guy that you've got, obviously, Michael Thomas, and you had, you know, some of the other young guys like Tre'Quan Smith, and you had Lil Jordan Humphrey. I think there was this concern that they would ask Dez to do a lot, and that wasn't the case. And maybe that if that's not the case in Dallas, there's still a possibility. But I will concede that it looks like the road is a little bit more narrow for him to come back. All right, so let's talk about what comes with wearing that number 88 and what Mr. 88 himself, one of the originals, Drew Pearson, has to say about all this in this new offense. We're now joined by a living legend. I am talking about the original 88, Drew Pearson. You can find him on Twitter at 88 Drew Pearson. Drew was one of the first co-host I had in sports. I don't know if you realize that we did the Drew Pearson show a long time ago, and I love seeing you continue to do media and thriving. Your thoughts as it related to this draft, Drew, and picking another 88 in CeeDee Lamb?
Yeah, well, first of all, I keep sending you those invoices and they keep returning return to sender for that payment you owe me for giving you your big break. But anyway, I was, first of all, surprised that CeeDee Lamb fell to the Cowboys. And I'm thinking, man, I think the reason is because Henry Ruggs went to, what, Denver? No, the Raiders.
Mm-hmm. Raiders.
And I think everybody expected Judy or CD to go ahead of Ruggs. But once he went ahead, it started changing the order a little bit and people's thinking. following that draft pick. So he ended up falling to the Cowboys, and right away what I did was pull up his highlights, okay? I'm like, whoa, this is a bad man here. And he's got the size and the speed. And the thing that's impressive, he runs good routes, and he's in that system where they have to run routes because they throw the ball a lot. And they have to run good routes, and he gets in the man-to-man coverage a lot. But the thing is, the action really starts after he makes the catch, okay? You see, yards after the catch is the reason why he averaged over 21 yards a catch at OU. So you bring that to our offense, and, man, that's going to make a big difference, no matter who's a quarterback, Dak, Andy, or whomever.
You know, Drew, you were somebody who, when we talk about the legacy of 88, I mean, you were the one who created it. You know, you were the one who started that legacy, and then it, of course, went to Michael Irvin, and then Dez Bryant, and now to CeeDee Lamb. So, you know, I don't think that you were kind of faced with the same sort of question about the number or anything that CeeDee Lamb seemed to be, where there's this discussion of should he take 88 or not. Talk about, I guess, just the legacy of that number and how you feel about CeeDee being the next to wear that.
Yeah, well, first of all, Bobby, nobody had it before I did. The reason it was available is because Ron Sellers had it the year before I had it, and he got traded to the Miami Dolphins for Otto Stowe. Otto Stowe had been playing behind Paul Warfield for 4 years, and he wanted to get out of there, so he forced a trade to come to Dallas, and he wore 82. And thank God he came to Dallas, because I learned how to play wide receiver in the NFL by watching Otto Stowe, okay? Mike Ditka was my receiver coach, wide receiver coach, okay? Mike Ditka knew nothing about wide receiver except my blocking assignments. He knew all that, but he didn't know how to run routes or anything. But anyway, the number was available, so after I made the team, you couldn't have the single-digit numbers. I had number 3 in college. I wanted that. 15 in high school, wanted that. Couldn't do that, so you had to go in the 80s. And so there wasn't that many numbers available. Billy Joe was the number 1 draft pick. He took 89. Golden Richard was number 2. He took 83. 85, who wants that? 87, no. Away, you know, so the only thing that really sounded decent was 88, and that's why I took it. But then after I did what I did in it and retired, you know, I started calling myself the original 88, okay, and it just kind of caught on, and people had forgotten that somebody else previously had worn 88. So I did what I did and set a tone for the 88s. But what made it a legacy, now Michael comes along, and you know, I was working for Channel 5, Scott Murray. He sends me out to DFW Airport to greet Michael as his plane comes in after he gets drafted. And, you know, first thing Michael says, Drew, they want me to wear number 88. Is that okay? I said, well, Michael, it's not my number, first of all. Second of all, if you do wear it, don't do what I did in it. Do more than I did. And, man, he did a lot more than I did, okay? Hall of Fame career individually, 3 Super Bowl championships and all that. So now we got something going. Now we got a legacy. If Michael doesn't do anything in the number 88, then it is no legacy. So now we got something going, and Dez comes along, and me and Michael got together with Dez, and we said, hey, Dez, you know, this is something that we want to carry on. And you were designated and anointed to do this because of your abilities and what you bring to the table and your similarities to us at that position. So Dez took it, and, man, he took off with it and had a nice career. He ended up the all-time touchdown leader, and I don't know how many yards. He's ahead of most of the us in yardage. I know he's ahead of me. So he took the number and did something with it, and now it's looked upon as a prestigious number in Cowboy number history, number lore. So now CD comes, and I didn't think, well, CD, you know, he's a different kind of receiver. I'm thinking maybe more of Bob Hayes. You know, Bob Hayes finished his career 20 yards a catch his whole career, okay? CD, 20 yards a catch, game breakers, going deep, you know, big plays and stuff like that. I'm thinking maybe Jerry's going to start another legacy going with the number 22. You know, Bob Hayes, Emmitt Smith, CD Lamb. But no, he had other reasons to anoint CD with the double eights. And, you know, from what I hear, he couldn't have gone wrong with passing it on to CeeDee Lamb.
What do you think about this new regime, Mike McCarthy? Because I know you've been following this team as closely as I have, even more so because you're so invested in it. Are you seeing things a little differently with this new regime and Mike at the helm as it relates to some of the decisions that the Cowboys have made this offseason?
Yeah, I guess you can put some of the reasons why they had such a good draft. You know, now you got a different voice in a room, different guy in the room looking for different things. I understand once he got the job, he got he and Will McClay got real close and they worked together. Will McClay found out what kind of players Mike McCarthy's looking for to run his offense and run his football team. And Will McClay, you know, has done a tremendous job, went out and got those players and found those kind of players. And, you know, so I think his voice in the meetings and the way they did things, having Jerry out on his boat out to sea somewhere where he couldn't mess with stuff. And I'm wondering, nobody said it. Was Will McClay on that boat? I don't think so. He's probably back at the headquarters feeding information, right? So Jerry couldn't get to him like he normally could get to him, you know, pull him aside and all that kind of stuff. So Will probably had the final say along with Mike McCarthy in a lot of the picks that the Cowboys made throughout the this draft, for sure.
Jerry's going to come for you for saying that. You know that.
I know. Just take me on the boat, Jerry. Now, get me out there and see and then do something.
Now, Drew, we talk about the 88 legacy. There's another legacy of yours that has been talked about for a long time, and that's as, you know, one of the great undrafted free agents, not just in Cowboys history, but in NFL history. And I want to find out if this is true, because this is something that I've heard, but I can't recall if you've ever said this yourself. Is it true? Because when we talk about these guys that we talked to Rondell Carter earlier, who's an undrafted free agent out of James Madison. He said it came down to the 49ers and the Cowboys, and he picked the Cowboys. And maybe nobody thinks anything of that now, but when you had your undrafted free agent decision, is it true that it came down to the Cowboys and the Steelers and we were this close to you being on the other side of that war in the 70s?
Well, actually, it came down between Green Bay, Pittsburgh, and Dallas. And Pittsburgh was real close, or the front runner pretty much, so because they offered the most money, all right? They offered me a signing bonus of $1,500,
woo!
All right? But the Cowboys impressed me. It had it in my head after I met with the Steelers, because the Cowboys were there at the second day of the draft. I'm in my college apartment at Tulsa University, and they had a scout there at the Camelot Hotel calling my house saying they couldn't believe I wouldn't draft it. Nah, 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 nah. Can you come down to the Camelot? And we want you to sign a contract and that type of thing. So I said, well, I can come down there, but you got to give me an hour because this is like 17 rounds of the draft. And after the 12th round, I'm drinking Boone's Farm, baby. I was drowned in my sorrows. And so I had to sober up before I went down there. So anyway, they offered me a contract right there. Base salary of $14,500 and a signing bonus of $150.
Wow.
And so I took that over to Steeler money. And I said to the scout, who the late Bob Griffin, I told him, I said, sir, if you pay me that signing bonus in cash, I'll sign right now. So he paid me in cash. 720s and a 10. And that's how I got my signing bonus with the Dallas Cowboys.
Isn't it wild?
It parlayed into a lot more. I don't know if it would have been the same situation. I know I wasn't going to Green Bay. I thought seriously about Pittsburgh, but I don't think it would have turned out as great as it did. If I ended up with the Dallas Cowboys, because Pittsburgh would have never had Lynn Swann. Therefore, when we played Pittsburgh in those games, Lynn Swann would have never made those catches. No, no, no. Anyway.
Isn't it wild when you think about some of those contracts? I mean, I love, what was your teammate that got the horse trailer, which was one of my favorite stories as part of his negotiations?
Was it Charlie Waters?
That was Charlie Waters.
Charlie Waters, yeah. Yeah, and let's see, somebody – they give us Grand Prix. I got a Grand Prix. And it was green. And hey, I tried to sell it. Nobody wanted the green car.
So funny. When I think about my first market, I mean, they didn't pay us anything in Tyler, Texas. $16,500 a year is what I made. And our big deal was trade. So you'd get like free hair, free gym membership and you took it because you're like, whatever you want to give me to sweeten what this deal is, I'd appreciate it. Before we let you go, Drew, one of the toughest things that I've watched in the last year was, I know a lot of people push for you to go in the Hall of Fame. I knew this was the year that you wanted it. You certainly had the career that warrants it. What was it like not getting that call and having cameras on you, Drew, in that moment?
Well, it was very disappointing. And, you know, I was felt, like I said, heartbroken, let down and that type of thing. And the only reason is because I had so much confidence that this was going to be the way I get in, okay? This was, according to Rick Gosselin and Shaureen Williams and Jerry Bell, this was the way for the Hall of Fame voting committee to make up for some of the mistakes that they made along the line. And I thought I was one of the most glaring mistakes that they made, not so much because of my ego and everything like that, but simply because I was all decade. Come on. You know, you voted for me all decade. And so then I see Harold Carmichael go in early, and I said, they must have made a call for him because he's there. You know, he's at the studio. I mean, he's showing up like that. And I said, I ain't even got a phone call yet. So I keep looking at my phone and all that. But the thing is, you know, this was the first time I've ever been a finalist. I've never even been in the room and to be considered. So this is the first time as a finalist. And I didn't know how finalists act. I thought if you're a finalist, you're supposed to have everybody there, you know, just in case you do go in. And so I had all the TV stations there. I worked for just about every TV station in the market. So I knew everybody. One guy calls, can I come? The next guy, yeah, I heard so-and-so, can I come? Yeah. Next thing you know, all the TV stations are there. And, you know, this is so early in the morning. But, you know, when the call didn't come down, that last pick went, I was really, really disappointed. And so I showed that emotion. That was real. Okay. And so what I hope that comes out of that is not so much people feel sorry for Drew Pearson and all that. What I hope comes out of that is these sports writers that have this vote understand what this really means to us, okay? You break our hearts when you turn us down in such a way that you do, you know? And I got turned down. I'm at least at home around friends and family. You know, how about Everson Walls a couple years ago when he's sitting in a room waiting for that knock to say, yeah, you're in. And got his friends and family there with him. No one showed the camera on him, the disappointment he felt, or anybody else that doesn't get in, a disappointment they feel. So this showed that emotion. And that's what I explained to Mr. Baker, David Baker, who called me shortly after this and was disappointed I didn't get in. He said I was on his list and he doesn't have a vote, but I was on his list thinking I would be one of the guys to go in. So, you know, what I told him is I hope the voting committee sees how we feel about this, how important this is to us. So don't play no bias games with us. Don't play no political games with us. You know, let this be a subjective vote based on what we brought to the league, our teams and the NFL during the time we played. And don't compare me with all these 1,000-yard catch receivers, you know. What did Michael Thomas had 144 catches in one season? Oh, my God. It took me 5 years to get that. You know? But anyway, so hopefully it'll come around. I talked to Rick Gosselin, Charlene, Jared Bell, Gary Myers. They all think that it'll happen. And, you know, look how God works, guys. You know, look at this situation now. We don't even know if there's going to be a ceremony this year at this point. Baseball canceled their Hall of Fame ceremony. We don't know what the season's going to be like or anything. So I've been texting Cliff and finding out if he's heard anything. He hasn't heard anything about anything solid about what they're going to do moving forward. So God put me in a position where sometimes the storms that come in your life don't come to disrupt your life. Sometimes they clear a path. And this path was going to be a little different for me to get to the NFL Hall of Fame. So that's how I look at it.
Well, I know this, when you've got the sour, it makes it so much sweeter when the good thing happens for you. And I know it's going to come for you. Look at Charles Haley, how long he had to wait. Terrell Owens, I remember how devastated he was. And then, of course, he just didn't even show up because he was so frustrated with it. I hope that's not the case for you. I hope they don't put you through this sort of angst again. But we really, really appreciate you coming on the show. Always a pleasure, Drew.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. And great stuff. You guys are mid-season form. Thank you.
Joining us now is former James Madison defensive end and new Cowboys defensive end, Rondell Carter. You can follow him on Twitter at RC5 with four underscores. Don't do one underscore, two underscores, three underscores. You're going to get different people. That's not Rondell Carter. Rondell Carter's RC5 with four underscores. Rondell, how you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for asking. How you guys doing?
Doing great. Good. Excited to have you here. So is there any consideration now, because I assume you're not going to be five at the next level. They don't really allow that for defensive ends. Is there any consideration for a Twitter handle change now?
Yeah, it's probably going to change. I'm probably going to keep the RC pod, but I'm going to just switch the number whenever I get my number. You know what I mean? So the second I get it, y'all will know, because it won't be RC5 anymore. It'll be RC whatever the Cowboys gave me. So we'll see.
What was your conversations with the Cowboys like leading up to the draft? Did you have any?
Yeah, so initially they were my first team that I talked to when once the season had ended. You know, like, so we went to Frisco for the national championship in Texas. We went to the national championship, and I got a text, you know, like the day, our national championship ended, I got a text, and it was from the player personnel director, if I'm not mistaken, and I believe her name was Stephanie. And I got the text from her, and they basically were set up a meeting because I had the NFLPA game in Los Angeles. And so that was, they were my first conversation. They were the first team that I talked to, first team that I friendly was like, I showed my dad. I was like, Dad, look, the NFL team texting me or whatever. So, and then, you know, moving forward, you know, I talked to them when I got in LA. That's how I got my Dallas Cowboys hat when the day came. And then I talked a few times, like, throughout the whole draft process. And then I finally talked to him, like, you know, round four-ish, round five-ish. I talked to Coach Thompson, the D-line coach. So, you know, those conversations are pretty cool, especially when I'm being the first team that I actually try to talk to.
Did you know did you have it in your head that, okay, if I go undrafted, Dallas is where I want to go? Or did you have a few teams that you were considering and Dallas ultimately won out?
Well, it was a lot. It was definitely a lot of, it was like 25 teams, honestly, and it came down to San Francisco and Dallas. That's what it honestly came down to. But, you know, as my agent looked it over, we just felt like Dallas was the best chance for me to make a roster spot. And then not to mention, obviously, that I was in Texas training for 2 months. So I got comfortable with Texas and I got familiar with the area. And then it was a lot of subliminals out there on why I should be with Dallas. In Frisco at the National Championship, they gave us cowboy hats like that, like the actual cowboy hat. My dad was wearing it the day before the draft all day. I don't know why, he just decided to wear a cowboy hat. And then, you know, the balloons that my family got me for my gathering, they were shaped like stars. And then my family, we just redid our living room, and now our living room is navy blue and white. So I don't know. It was a lot of subliminal messages out there that, hey, Dallas might be the way.
Just like Neville Gallimore. Neville told us that he went to the car wash, and a woman asked him here in the Dallas area, are you a Dallas Cowboy? And he wasn't at the time, but he said he was going to go back and find her because he doesn't want her to think that he lied to her. But he also trained here. I got to ask you, so – a guy like Neville Gallimore, but let's talk about the guys they already have on the line. DeMarcus Lawrence, the possibility of Aldon Smith and Randy Gregory coming back. When you look at that defensive line and you look at playing with a guy like, or having a coach like Jim Tomsula, what does that mean to you?
It means a lot. You know what I mean? Because it's one thing making it to the NFL, but, you know, you have to maintain yourself. You have to stay there. You know what I mean? And when you have good people that you can learn from, it always gives you an opportunity to extend your career. You know, so learning from under guys that were proven vets, you know what I mean, like Tank Lawrence and Aldon Smith and Randy Gregory. These guys know how to play the game. And then you got Coach Thompson, who knows how to teach it, you know. So when you get a guy like that coaching you, like, you have to be nothing more than excited, because it's, I don't know, it's just like, you know, you're going to go and learn something. You know, you're going to be able to develop as a football player. You know what I mean? When you can do that, it just makes your career go that much longer. And I just can't wait to come in and learn under those players and those coaches.
We've heard from the Cowboys that they're likely to maintain their 4-3 front, but that they're going to be multiple. That's one of the new buzzwords this offseason, multiple. They want to have some 3-4 looks and things like that. When you talked with the Cowboys and were making the decision to come here, did they talk to you at all about what they envisioned for you? Did they talk about, you know, you're going to have your hand in the dirt, or did they say, hey, you're going to do some flexible stuff for us too? You might stand up some, you might be rushing off the edge. Did you have any of those type of conversations with them?
Yep. So Coach Thompson told me I'll be defensive end, hand in the dirt kind of guy. And that's basically what I've been doing. I was in college, you know what I mean? I was a hand in the dirt kind of guy. But I have stood up before, you know what I mean? I've had slid down to three technique and pass rush, you know what I mean? So who knows? Hopefully I can be able to show my versatility when I'm out there. Hopefully that gives me a better chance at making it. And I had, like I said, I had stood up before when I was at Rutgers, and I've dropped back into coverage at times. So, You know what I mean? Luckily, I've done all three of those things. I've stood up, I've had my hand in dirt, and I've actually moved inside to third down and pass rush. So, you know, hopefully I can just show I can do all those things, and hopefully that gives me a shot at making the team.
You know, I did notice this draft, some of you guys are coming in with people that you know. We talked about Neville Gallimore getting his teammate CeeDee Lamb in Dallas. You're getting Ben DiNucci, the backup quarterback. What was the text like? Was it just fire when you guys said, oh my gosh, we're both heading to Frisco?
Actually, I called him. You know, when we had a conversation, he had his hat on. I had my hat on. We were just talking, man. It was exciting. My dad talked to him. You know what I mean? I seen his family on the FaceTime call. My brother actually recorded our FaceTime call. So, you know, I think my brother has it on his Twitter. Maybe I'll be able to get it from him. But, yeah, me and him had a great conversation. You know what I mean? It was really fun just to be able to just talk to each other. Actually, we're going to be able to be playing with each other in Dallas. Me and him have the same kind of personality. He's a fun guy. So, you know what I mean? I'm looking forward to that.
You were, of course, at James Madison, which is an FCS-level school. And there's always those questions from people about, you know, the level of competition and you know, how prepared is this person to step into the NFL after coming from that level? But, you know, you did have a couple games against some bigger schools, West Virginia. I know you had a good game against them. You played against NC State, had good games against them. You started out at Rutgers, which is a Power 5 school. So do you think that you're better prepared for this jump than it may look like at first glance of just a guy coming from an FCS school?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what's funny is, you know, a lot of people don't really get it, but, you know, the FCS level at the CAA, my conference, is the toughest conference you can play in. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of talent there. Me coming from the Big Ten level and then coming down to the CAA, I mean, obviously you have your Big Ten 6'7", 330-pound, you know, tackles, but you'll get your fair share of those in the CAA as well. You know, so it's not like I just went down to a level in a conference and it's like no competition. You know, the competition is there, and if anybody plays in it, they'll know. And then not only that, like I said, we played those FBS teams in those games that I've excelled. And then luckily, I had the chance to play the NFLPA game, and I went against all FBS people, you know, so, and I did well against them as well. So, I mean, it really doesn't matter because, like, I do feel like I'm prepared because I've had the Rutgers experience. I played in the toughest conference in FCS, and then I had an NFLPA game when I was able to excel as well. So, I'm prepared.
We are so excited to have you on this podcast and excited to talk to you in the locker. And when that ever happens here, we wait for sort of news about this pandemic and how it relates to the football season and training camp. But wish you the best of luck and we'll see you soon.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
We're now joined by Ron Slavin, NFL agent with Sports Stars. You might recognize him as Leighton Vander Esch's agent. You've got quite a few guys with the Cowboys. You had Orlando Scandrick as well, Ron. So we're excited to get you in here because I feel like we've got a lot to cover, specifically Leighton Vander Esch. I know a lot of people have been concerned about that injury, the neck injury that he sustained last year. What's the latest on him?
Leighton's great. I actually just got the phone with him. He's flying back to Dallas now because people that had surgery in the offseason can be at the facility and get treatment and do the things they need to do to get ready for the season. So he was doing great. Diet plan was great, getting stronger, all those things. And then when the whole quarantine and they shut everything down, he went back to Idaho for a little bit, but now he's coming back to Dallas actually today. So he can get back with the training staff and get back to doing what he does here.
And look, we know he's an avid hunter. He grew up, you know, his father is one of those outfitters that takes you off to go find the big bears. I saw he and his lovely wife, Maddie, have been out doing that. So I would imagine if you're able to hold a gun, that neck and that whole region up top is probably okay, right?
He says he feels better now than he's felt in his life. And I think it was always, he had some tightness in there that now that it's been fixed, he's looser and range of motion, all those things are better. I mean, he played last year that season trying to tackle with one arm. I know there's a lot of talk about the missed tackles, but he had a stinger early on. And then once he got landed on in that Philly game, which is just a one in a million deal where somebody or two people fall on you the way that they fell on him. It's just a set of circumstances that was unfortunate, but now he gets it fixed. Now he's coming into the season ready to go. And I think you're going to get an even better Leighton Vander Esch in 2020.
Ron, in terms of, you know, we talk about Leighton Vander Esch and he's obviously a Boise guy and Jane referenced you've had a few Boise guys come through. I feel like you were probably the agent ahead of that, the Boise explosion in the NFL. I know you've repped a lot of guys there. And people talk about the Dallas-Boise connection. They kind of make jokes about it. I know one of your guys, Curtis Weaver, told us when we talked to him before the draft that that was what he said to the Cowboys, that, you know, oh, I know we're your pipeline and things like that. What is it, do you think, about the Boise pipeline that Dallas likes so much? And I mean, just your experience with that program, with those players, what do you think it is that brings Dallas to that well so often?
Well, so I've been getting guys out of Boise since 2008. And the one thing that, and the reason, once I got Orlando was, you know, he's a different personality than most, because he's got the chip on his shoulder and he's angry about everything all the time. But it worked for Orlando, and it worked, you know, as a player. And the reason he lasted as long as he did in the league, because he always wanted to prove everybody wrong. And I think that's the mentality of all the Boise guys, is that every, you know, I talk about this all the time, but the 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12 years at Boise, they go to Virginia Tech and beat them in the opener. They go to Georgia and Atlanta and beat them in the opener. This year they beat Florida State in the opener. So they go to these big Power 5 conference teams, always to open the season to prove a point. They win. And then the rest of the year, you're trying to just keep credibility and keep your ranking up, because you're playing in the Mountain West. So these players are always like, we beat these guys, we're better than these guys, but they never get the respect they get. And they feel like that when they come to the NFL too. I mean, for all the talent that they've had, very few of them have gone in the first round. I mean, with Leighton going in the first round, it was, they hadn't had somebody since Shane McClellan and Doug Martin, but they had all these really good players coming out that were going in the second to seventh round. And Leighton's scenario just worked out perfect, because he was the Brian Urlacher 2.0. Jane, you and I talked about it leading up to the draft, that, you know, because Marinelli was there and Will McClay and Ben Bloom all had their eyes on Leighton that whole lead up to the draft. And Leighton did everything he needed to do, went to the combine and dominated. His pro day was great. Personal meetings and visits were great. So he was the perfect storm to get picked by the Cowboys at 19. But the rest of these guys just have their chip on their shoulder, so they want to prove everybody wrong for the whole time they're in the league. And I mean, I have Charles Leno, who's a seventh round pick, and he's been the starting left tackle in Chicago for 6 years now. Got a $40 million contract. Every year, though, Charles is always saying, I have to get better. I have to prove to people that I belong. So it doesn't matter, even after they get paid, they always have that chip on the shoulder, because they're always told they're not good enough, or, oh, you aren't the Pac-12, or you aren't, you know, SEC. When in reality is, if you put Boise in the Pac-12, I think they'd win a lot more games than they'd lose.
Well, and you look at Leighton and a guy who was a walk-on at Boise and had to fight to even make that team and get the scholarship and everything. I think a lot of people view Leighton as just kind of a quiet guy and you know, down-to-earth, small-town guy. But, I mean, he did have that background of being a walk-on. Do you think he also has a little bit of that chip on his shoulder? Because I don't know that people look at him that way.
No, yeah, he, even though he went 19 overall, Leighton still wants to prove to everybody that he can be the best linebacker in the NFL. It's just not, I was a first round pick, I made it, and I'm done. He wants to prove everybody wrong. I mean, people forget too that Leighton was, you know, the best basketball player in the state of Idaho in high school. And he went and played in these AAU tournaments, and he was playing against big time guys who are now in the NBA. And Leighton was dunking on those guys. But Leighton wasn't getting D1 offers that a lot of these guys were, because he was playing for an AAU team out of Idaho. But I believe that if Leighton would have gone the basketball route, and even if he would have had a walk-on at Boise State for basketball, Leighton probably would have played in the NBA. Because a guy, you know, 40-inch vert, 6'5", he can dunk on people, he can shoot from 25 feet all day long. I mean, his whole family's basketball players. All his sisters played college basketball. His mom was a really good basketball player. So the basketball background too is another reason why he's so good at football, because of the lateral movement stuff, lateral quickness. But I think no matter what Leighton would have done, he would have excelled at it. And probably, like, I know people are like, oh, Ron's just his agent, he's always just going to pump up his guys. But I think Jane can attest to this. I don't really BS much. I tell people what I'm really, you know, what the truth is. And I think that if Leighton would have played basketball, he would have been in the NBA. If Leighton wouldn't have been an athlete, he would have been a Navy SEAL and probably killed Osama bin Laden. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's the kind of stuff that Leighton could have done.
This is why Ron is so good as an agent. I my agent's pretty awesome with William Morris, but I want him to speak this highly of me when people inquire. I do want to ask you, obviously he hasn't had a lot of time with Mike Nolan in this new defense, but Mike McCarthy's saying it's going to be a 4-3 defense with 3-4 principles. How do you see Leighton fitting into this scheme now?
I think Leighton is going to have two bigger bodies in front of him that they haven't had, with McCoy and Poe. So there's going to be a lot more lanes for him to run through, not just sideline to sideline on the pass defense, but he's going to be able to shoot in those gaps and make a bunch of plays. I think the game that would stick out to me the most that would kind of the way that they played that game was the Saints game 2 years ago, the Thursday night game, 13-10, I think the final was where Layton was shooting the gaps and he had a couple stops in fourth and one on Kamara and Ingram, and then also making plays sideline to sideline, you know, sniffing out some of those screen passes to Kamara. So I think if fans want to know what they're going to see from Layton and in this defense, I think that's the game where I think they schemed up the Saints that way. And I think that's what you're going to see more of with this defense.
Now, you're not just the agent for Leighton Vander Esch. I know a lot of people are now familiar with you as the agent for Aldon Smith, who a lot of Cowboys fans are really excited about. I think they kind of saw that coming out of nowhere. You, I'm sure, didn't. You were probably working things, you know, behind the scenes for several weeks, several months leading up to it. What was it that made you confident in Aldon Smith and in that you wanted to represent him? I mean, you haven't repped him his entire time in the league. So what drew you to Aldon Smith and made you believe in him that he's ready to go?
Jay Glazer had called me in December and said, Aldon, you know, has been sober since June, July. He's wants to get back to football. He's been training with me at my gym. Bunch of coaches have been through here. Mike McCarthy went through there because his daughter trains there at the same gym. You know, a bunch of different people had seen him. And then a few other people around the league that I know had called and said that they've seen Aldon, they've met with Aldon. He's in a good place. So Aldon came to Dallas, met with him here, decided that we were going to work together. And then when I went to the combine, had a letter that was showing that the reinstatement was going to happen, or that we were working on the reinstatement. So then a bunch of teams started calling me. Aldon wanted to go somewhere where he was comfortable. So Vic Fangio's in Denver, Pete Carroll and John Schneider had done a really nice job leading up to the draft when Aldon came out. You know, they didn't think Aldon was going to go 7 overall. They were going to try to maybe move up and grab Aldon. And then the 49ers took him earlier than people even expected. And then Dallas, because McCarthy and Aldon had hit it off pretty well when they had met. And then Jim Tomasula was his coach in San Francisco, so he had a relationship there. And then Jay and the Jones family is pretty tight. So there's just a lot of different pieces that fit. I didn't want to make the decision for Aldon just because I live in Dallas. I didn't want, you know, him saying, oh, Ron's just pushing the Cowboys because Ron has a bunch of guys in the Cowboys now. I wanted Aldon to make the decision for himself. So as the season went on, no matter what happened, you know, everything doesn't work out all the time, right? I mean, there's a reason guys only last in this league for 3.5 years. So I wanted to make sure that he felt comfortable with it. And then once we went through the whole process and talked to the teams, he called me and was like, it was March 30th, I think. And he's like, I know that Dallas is the place I want to be. So we worked out the contract. And then I know Jay put it out on a show on April 1st. And people were like, is this April Fool's? Aldon Smith's really going to be a Cowboy? But it was real. And Aldon's here in Dallas. He flew in on Friday and he's working out and just staying ready for hopefully a reinstatement that happens sooner than later.
Why should fans and the Cowboys feel comfortable with Aldon coming back?
I think there's probably a lot of fans out there that have had either substance abuse problems or family members that had substance abuse problems. And you just have to have faith that the person is going to, at some point in their life, figure it out that, do I want to, you know, drink myself to death, or, you know, we have a major opioid problem in this country. Do I want to kill myself with those things, or do we want to get our life in order and straight? I think Aldon's in a really good spot, and, you know, alcohol has been Aldon's problem, and he knows that that's the problem. I think he recognizes that. You know, he's like, I always was blaming everybody else, but it was on me and I can't always play the victim. So once he said he figured that out, he's been in a really good place. He said he's happier than he's ever been. And I mean, every time I'm around him, I see more and more cool things about Aldon. And I mean, he's in incredible shape. And he got off the plane the other day, I was like, oh my God, like this, if he is the player he was last time he was on the field and he's this much bigger and stronger, I fear for NFL quarterbacks.
You know, the Cowboys are have been known to take on players with, you know, questionable issues in their past, or basically, you know, they're willing to believe in guys and their redemption. As Jerry told Jane near the end of last year that he believes in redemption. He's a comeback story guy. And because of that, when they've had some of these guys come onto the team before, it's been typical of the Cowboys that they'll set them up with some sort of accountability system or accountability partner. Somebody's designated for that. Is anything like that in place for Alden that the Cowboys have talked about, or are they just comfortable with him coming in here and operating on his own?
I admire the Jones family for giving people second chances. You know, fans turn on players too quick. I feel like people make mistakes. A lot of fans sitting at home have made mistakes. Nobody's perfect. And I admire the Joneses for giving a lot of these guys second chances that a lot of teams wouldn't. I think with Alden, the reason we had so much interest, because everybody knew Alden was a good person. He wasn't out there doing a lot of the things that were said about him. It was just the alcohol was killing him. And they recognize that, and they know that, you know, if he has the right people around him, he's going to be okay. To answer the second part of your question is, myself, because I'm a control freak, is going to manage the situation. They haven't been perfect here. No team is perfect with the people they surround them with. Unfortunately, when you have people with problems, there's other people that come out of the woodwork that all of a sudden are experts, or they want to be they think they can solve those problems. Well, if you're not a real expert, just stay away from my client. So I'm going to handle it. We have Alden's support system around him. It's a very small circle, and I think that's the way we're going to be successful.
Speaking of being successful, you have obviously done a couple of contracts with the Cowboys as an agent. Dak Prescott, a contract I think a lot of us thought were going to get done last summer, still hasn't gotten done. And then the signing of Andy Dalton. Talk to me about the art of the deal as it pertains to the Cowboys. Obviously, this is like me asking you to diagnose a patient that you haven't seen the x-rays and actually gone in there and done the blood work. But as somebody on the outside, do you think that this deal gets done, and what's it going to take for it to get done?
First, I don't think the sign of Andy Dalton has any effect on Dak Prescott. How many times do we see teams, their starting quarterback gets hurt and then the season's over because they don't have somebody capable backing up? No disrespect to Cooper Rush, but Andy Dalton is a proven NFL quarterback. They got him on a very low number. His family's here in Dallas. I think it makes a lot of sense because of the quarantine and because of things that are going on. He spends time with his family. He's in Dallas. The minute the training camp opens up, whether it's the end of July, middle of August, whenever things start back up, he can drive over to the Star and get to work. So that part of it makes a lot of sense for Andy. I don't think it has any effect on Dak, because Dak's the starting quarterback, and Dak's number should be Dak's number.
Looking back at just circling back to Leighton, I'm curious, because I don't know that people ever know this sort of aspect of Leighton and who he is as a player and as a person. I know the Cowboys, there was some talk last year at the end of last year that some people were like, did the Cowboys get the leadership that they needed on defense? Was there somebody there that was, you know, the driving force? And with Leighton being out there for that last half of the season when that stuff started turning up, do you think Leighton is somebody that can step in the season and supply some of that and kind of step into that role?
Definitely. I mean, Leighton always talked about year three being the year where, you know, it was where he was comfortable enough in the locker room, being around the people long enough where that leadership role can take effect. I think that Leighton is in a good place now. He's earned the respect of his teammates, the way he works, the way he handles himself. I think this is a year where Leighton should, you know, step up and become the leader that I'm sure the Cowboys would love him to be.
He reminds me so much of Sean Lee, Bobby, Ron. Every time I see the way that he approaches film, the way that he carries himself. So that's good news. And the fact that you've got Sean Lee back yet another year, especially if we're looking at seeing more of these 3-4 sets, just needing some extra linebacker. It certainly looks like they've started to improve this team, something that I didn't feel was necessarily addressed. Ron, thank you so much for your time. I love that you're a no BS guy. So we'll definitely get you back here on the show, since this was your inaugural voyage here on the Boys and Girl podcast. Thank you so much for joining the show. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right. Well, what an informative show. I've really enjoyed this offseason, getting to know not only some of these prospects leading up to the draft, but now the guys that are on this Cowboys roster. Have been really impressed with them so far, and just love some of those nuggets from Drew Pearson and Ron Slavin. So again, those of you that are continuing to follow us here on our podcast on The Herd, don't forget we're now up on YouTube.
Yep, you can follow us there and you can see all these video interactions we have and some of the fun extra aspects that come with that in these conversations. And like Jane said, we've had some really great conversations. This is a good batch of rookies, I feel like. I think Dallas lucked out this year in terms of from the media perspective that I think we got a lot of good guys this year.
We like to call them good ambassadors. I think these guys are going to be good ambassadors of the Cowboys and of the league. And let's hope that we don't have hot takes exposed and we're revisiting this at the end. But again, to our fans that continue to tune in, thank you so much. We'll see you on the next one.